Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. When is a flood zone not a flood zone? We hear about a billion-dollar Hawaiian Electric power plant that hangs in the balance. The NPR show Planet Money has been teaching us about economics for nearly two decades. We learn about a new book breaking down the economic forces that shape our daily lives. Plus, it's National Garden Month. We head out to the garden to talk about an upcoming show highlighting flowers and horticulture. And Balinese Shadow Puppets Go Big, an upcoming production, opens this Friday. We go behind the curtains to see how the magic gets made. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, Honolulu Civil Beat has a story that may have you thinking, what? The headline is Hawaiian Electric may be screwed. Here to talk about why that may be is Stuart Yurton. He covers business for Civil Beat. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yes. So, flood zone? Tell us about this.
Yeah. Okay. So, the main issue is that no new energy projects are supposed to be developed in flood zones. Now this HECO project at its Waiau plant near Pearl Harbor is in one because of updated flood maps that FEMA has issued. And the PUC approved the project anyway, and didn't really address the flood zone issue.
It's a head scratcher, you know, because this is a massive project, and they're about to infuse a bunch of money in this to upgrade it. But yeah, I'm scratching my head, like, why didn't anyone flag this sooner?
Yeah, we don't know exactly. HECO said that they knew about FEMA's plan to change the flood zone, but the utility thought, well, our facilities are all above ground, we're on a slope, there's never been a flood there in the nearly 90 years we've operated Waiau, so we should be okay.
Yeah, but we're talking about $1 billion, right, that they're investing and they're waiting on final approvals?
Yeah, the PUC gave approval but said you can only spend $847 million plus some adjustment for inflation. And HECO said, no, we need the full $1.15 billion, and they're going back and forth on that. That's pending before the PUC.
And talk about how you folks came across this, well, because it was a filing, right?
Yeah, it was a filing, a public comment with the PUC. It's we don't know the source. They're calling themselves concerned ratepayers of Oahu, and we don't know who they are. We can infer from this 71-page document that a lot of work went into it, probably by some very good lawyers or consultants.
Yeah, I mean, your sense is not something that AI generated?
No, this wouldn't be an AI thing. Again, because of the anonymous nature of this, we really only report in the story today what we verified, the main arguments that we verified, and then we also called the mayor's office, which concurred with the general conclusion that, yeah, this is in a flood zone now, and it could trigger some additional regulatory issues for HECO.
And talk about Hawaiian Electric's response.
Well, again, they're saying we're built up high. It shouldn't be an issue. We've never had a flood in nearly 90 years, and that's it. They also, one of the issues involves a federal loan, and because of the flood zone designation, the feds are now going to have to do this 8-step review of the loan application. Ultimately, all of this is just means, at the very least, more time and money for HECO to deal with this, and HECO doesn't have a lot of time, and the money is important as well. The PUC said, no, you can't spend all that you want to spend on this, and at least you can't charge the ratepayers for it.
Yeah, and I know probably customers are a little bit wary, right? We've been hearing about the request by the state to delay this project because of some talks that the administration's having with a Japanese company about liquefied natural gas. So, yeah, it's just all very intriguing, and I'd be curious to see if we can figure out, you know, who put this report or this analysis together.
Yeah, we can only speculate, but we'll try to find out. I don't think anybody's going to cop to doing that, so it could remain a mystery.
Well, keep on digging. But thanks so much, Stuart.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking with Honolulu Civil Beat business reporter Stuart Yurton. You can read his story online at civilbeat.org.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. Artist John Violinist performs two sets this Saturday with music that blends contemporary R&B, soul, and modern violin. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Many of us are familiar with the important role the economy plays in our lives. We recently highlighted how the war in the Middle East impacts Hawaii's tourism numbers and marked how a year of tariff uncertainty has affected local businesses. Planet Money is an award-winning economics podcast from NPR. It debuted at the height of the 2008 financial crisis. Since then, it's spun off a comic book series, a TikTok channel, and most recently, a book, all with the goal of explaining the economic forces that shape our lives. Kenny Malone is a host of Planet Money, and Alex Mayossi is a contributor and author of the new book. They recently spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender. Mayossi starts us off.
I think I can brag about this book without sounding insane because this book is not just me. This book has incredible contributions, smart ways to explain economic ideas, contributions from the Planet Money team, which is really talented and has really honed their approach to explaining economics over 15 years of making the Planet Money podcast. And I think what's really special about the Planet Money approach is explaining economic concepts through storytelling. So there are all these just like delightful stories in this book about how Desi Arnaz of I Love Lucy invented the business model of television, of food bankers teaming up with economists to figure out how to more efficiently and effectively get food to people who need it. And so I think that just makes this book really fun and special. And it looks completely unlike anything you've ever seen. It is full color, full of surreal, amazing illustrations, charts and graphs, diversions, fun Easter eggs for anyone who listens to the show. So I just don't think you will have seen or read anything like it before.
Totally.
And if I may, this is Kenny. There's a chapter about finding love. And so, listen, I can't promise that reading the Planet Money book is going to solve all of your love problems, but I can't tell you it won't.
I absolutely love the art style and the storytelling, and it really is just a natural extension of the podcast. But Kenny, a question I have for you. Early on in the book, it reads, economic principles offer a set of tools for making society and ourselves better off, for getting the most wealth and happiness we can from our scarce resources. I think that that is definitely a lofty goal of economics. But when you look at something like skyrocketing fuel prices and tariffs and all the uncertainty we live in these days, how are you, as a person who works on economics every single day, still finding joy in this medium, which has the potential to do a lot of harm, I think?
I think it's very complicated. I think it's like the way I have come to think about economics and money is we all live in this kind of, you know, this system that is like a giant functioning body of sorts. And there's the money is sort of the blood that flows through the body, and it's a complicated vessel, and problems pop up. And economics is not like some panacea that's meant to fix the whole thing, but it is meant to be a kind of way to assess the world and think about the world. And there may be solutions to problems that crop up through economics. There may be explanations for things that do not fix problems, but at least help you understand things. So if you look at like skyrocketing fuel prices, it's very frustrating and it is causing a lot of harm and a lot of pain for people. Then that's all real. But then there are also ways to think about that in an economic mindset that's a bit distanced, it's true, but you think about how, why is this happening? It's because of a shortage of fuel. It's because of demand for fuel. And these are also signals. These are price signals for people to try and produce more. In theory, that should incentivize people to somehow get more fuel and to produce more fuel. And so if you think of it like almost like a, I don't know, almost like a doctor looking at the system, you can decide how you want to fix problems, if you need to fix problems, what's broken. But I don't think I think of it in terms of this one concept that's supposed to fix everything. Mm. I think people still are required to make good decisions and to work together to make decisions. And oftentimes the flaws we find are from the people and not necessarily the system. Though often it is the system, to be clear.
Planet Money has been known for making things that aren't just audio. I think of the comic book Microface, right?
Microface!
And the whole
Betty's
series.
Betty's Baby!
Oh my gosh, I was obsessed with that however many years ago it was.
Thank you, Maddie.
And then also the t-shirt. I mean, there are so many projects in which like Planet Money does something that's not audio in order to understand some broader series of economic principles. And Alex and Kenny, if I can ask you kind of a meta question here, what did you learn about the economics of book publishing and the whole, I mean, system of getting a book to print in writing this book?
Well, great, great prompt. We are making an entire 3-episode series about what we learned about the publishing industry by making a book. One of the things that I found really interesting is that there was this kind of moment where our publisher had to make a decision about where to print the book, maybe in China, maybe in Southeast Asia, maybe in the United States. And there were these kind of trade-offs for each one. So, for example, printing in the United States is more expensive, but it gives you more flexibility where if you sell lots and lots of copies, then it's easier and faster to print more copies and get them in bookstores faster. So there was this kind of interesting moment where our publisher was making all kinds of judgments to make a final call about where to print it. And, you know, there was this giant wrench thrown into it as well, that this is when tariffs were kicking off. So there was a lot of uncertainty there that, you know, might change the price of the book, might argue for printing in one place or another. So even that's just like one decision about where to physically print the book that involved a lot of the economic forces that are actually in this book and that we describe and explain.
And one of the things that I've learned about is our book proposal went to auction. So the various publishers could bid on what they were willing to pay for the Planet Money book, basically, to be the publisher of it. And, you know, I've heard of books going to auction. This is a thing I was vaguely aware of. What I did not know is that there are different auction systems that the person with the proposal, or in this case, our agents, I guess, that they would utilize to try and maximize different parts of the process. Like there's one auction model you'd use to get the most bids out of all of the publishers, but then they might get exhausted and start bailing out because they're like, ugh, it's not worth this work. But there's another one where it's like really fast, but you may not maximize the amount of money because of that, but you retain interest of many publishers. So I think we ultimately went with something that was like called the wedding cake model, which was very fun. And that I believe may have single-handedly inspired my co-host, Alexi Horowitz-Ghazi, to report the entire first episode of this series as a long drawn out wedding analogy, which it's incredible how long he keeps that ball in the air, I have to say. And it's really interesting. I didn't know any of that stuff about how books get made. It's one of these things that's right under our nose. And it's true. I didn't really understand how they arrive in the bookstore in the form that they're in.
Yeah, I'm picturing like the floor of a Sotheby's auction and someone with a gavel saying, and the rights to this book for 10,000 going
it
once.
It would have been very fun if we got
such
together.
Good audio, yes. Live. But it wasn't that. It's very quiet. It's emails, little emails sent over the course of 3 hours or something. I don't remember the time period, but yeah.
I do think that's a good example of how people might imagine book publishing is kind of like old school and people who are not very sophisticated economic actors. And clearly that is not the case. Like They are designing complicated auctions and thinking through trade-offs. They're making these complicated economic decisions and bets. And I think that's true in all sorts of industries where we don't normally think about the economics at work, you know, restaurants, book publishing. Like, the entire economy is full of examples of people grappling with economic forces every day. And that's why, like, the ideal Planet Money episode, the ideal Planet Money book chapter, there is a person grappling with these economic forces and ideas firsthand.
One last question for you, Kenny. It is our membership campaign ongoing right now, where we try to convince listeners to become supporters of this station. Less than 10% of listeners donate. What economic principles should they keep in mind as they think about the decision whether to step up and support their local public radio station?
Less than 10%, Maddie? Okay, to anybody listening, there is economics that I think supports what's going to happen to you when you decide to give, you 90%ers who are listening but not giving. So when economists have studied why people give to things, there are any number of reasons. But this thing that they consistently find is called, and I love this because in economics, most of the terms are like very harsh and cold, but this one is called the warm glow. Have you ever heard of this, Maddie?
I have not.
Okay. So basically, warm glow is like what's left when economists control for all the other reasons that people might be giving philanthropically. And what they found is there just is a feeling that people get and like to get when they give, and they call it the warm glow. And so, Maddie, my challenge for you, and this is something that I've tried to do at various member stations where I've worked or worked with, is to try to capture what warm glow might feel like for your listeners. What are the sounds that when you mash them all together might give you a sense of the warm glow that Hawaii Public Radio listeners might get from giving? Maybe it's the sounds of specific birds mixed with the sounds of waves crashing. I don't know. That's up to you. But I would challenge you to mix something together to let people get a sense of what they might feel when they give, the warm glow effect.
Okay. I'm going to try my very best to do that. And listeners can let me know if that adequately encompasses how they feel after they give.
I will say, I typically throw like a little crackling fire into the mix when I do this to show people. But maybe that, I don't feel like that makes as much sense for your listeners. Like,
maybe not here. I'm thinking wave sounds. I'm thinking native birds, maybe like the crunch of leaves or grass under your feet as you go through a hike.
Oh, it's good. It's good. And so you layer that all together. It'll be beautiful. And then any of the 90%ers who are not giving are going to listen. And just imagine that times like 100. And that's what warm glow is going to feel like. And why would they not give at that point?
Ugh, I don't know why not. Kenny Malone, Alex Mayasi, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for making time for us.
Such a pleasure.
Really appreciate it.
Ah, yes, the sounds of Hawaii. That was NPR's Kenny Malone and Alex Mayasi talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. The Planet Money book on economics is out now. Find out more by heading to planetmoneybook.com.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Dowling Company. For more than three decades, building housing for the Maui community and committed to building in balance, an HPR supporter since 2001.
You know, April happens to be National Garden Month, so this week we thought it would be nice to feature the Garden Club of Honolulu. It's an offshoot of the Garden Club of America, the GCA. Conservation is a big focus of the national organization, and the local club has embraced that idea and has run with it. Its big flower show opens in a couple of weeks. Mark your calendars. It is May 8th to the 10th at the Honolulu Museum of Art. The theme is Imagine That. Sharon Williams is president of the local chapter, and Williams explains how the organization has become more political in recent times.
Well, it started for me personally when I interviewed Senator Hirono about 3 years ago, because she co-sponsored the April as National Native Plant Month bill. And during that interview, I asked her what we could do to help. And she said, I'd like to see every student in the public school system learn about the importance of native plants by celebrating April, and by doing so, by planting a native tree. So I said, okay, well, let me see what I can do. And so then 2-3 weeks later, I got a call from her office saying, Senator Hirono is coming to town, wants to know if you'll help her plant an ohia tree at Bishop Museum. And she would love to hear about your plans for getting the DOE involved in this. And so I scrambled, and there's so many great, good-hearted people in town. And we put together a program, to make a long story short, and we got together a Partners for Plant grant through the Garden Club of America. And we've been growing native trees and donating them to DOE schools. And every year we're growing more and more. So, well, maybe the first year, I think we donated trees to 8 schools. And the second year, we focused on getting that Partners for Plant grant and had to get the DOE superintendent to approve it. We had to get an advisor, and that's Matt Keir, who's a state botanist with DLNR. And then the last 2 years, we've been working on this program with Jennifer Ryan over at the Department of Education, who's taken this little idea of maybe just working at first on Oahu, and she went and expanded it statewide this year. So we were able to offer plants, trees to 51, I think it was, schools this year, and keep on growing. We hope more people will come to us and ask us for trees, because we're happy to keep on nurturing them to give away.
Well, you know, I just talked to the forestry division with the city and county, and they are going to need help because they lost so many trees, and they're still doing a count with the latest storms.
We've been nurturing some. We have some to give away.
Yeah, but they are going to need help from the community to plant new trees to replace all the ones that have stood for years. But because of the flooding and the, you know, saturated soil, they've fallen over and they've been taken down. But yeah, it just sounds like there will be great opportunity for these students to really make a difference in our landscape across Oahu.
I always hope so, for their sake as well as ours. Yeah.
Yeah, so as far as what you folks will be focusing on for this flower and horticulture show, you know, talk about what people can expect to see when they show up.
Well, with the horticulture division, they are focusing on natives. So, for example, the hala trees and koa trees, it's the alahe'e, ali'i. Yeah, we're going to have a whole lot of native plants that are shown, not only the specimen in the horticulture division, but also in the education exhibit. Basically, sustainability is going to include a whole area full of native trees that people can see as well. They're just beautiful.
And so, gosh, this whole idea of conservation and getting back to the natives, has that always been the focus of the GCA?
No, it hasn't, but it is now. I mean, since Senator Hirono's effort and because of what's happening, island-wide, the Hawaiian community has always known it. And I found out because I was working on a conservation study conference in 2022 that there's this incredible group of people here who are, you know, Chipper Wickman from National Tropical Botanical Garden, and Sam Gahn, Kevin Chang, Celeste Connors, let's see, Alani Wilhelm, Nainoa Thompson. I know I'm missing some names, forgive me, guys, but these people all understand the interconnection of the ecosystem from the top of the ridge all the way down to the ocean and around the world. And it's an interconnectedness that the Native Hawaiians understood at a scientific level that I wasn't even aware of until I talked to these people only, what, 4 years ago. But the Native Hawaiians were so wise about how they managed the ecosystem that they were able to sustainably feed a population they think was about 1.3 million people for almost 2,000 years. It's amazing how they were able to engineer the ecosystem and augment it.
Yeah, when you think of that phrase, Mauka to Makai, right? How
yeah.
It's all integrated.
It's all integrated. It's amazing. Like, for example, just the fish ponds alone, they watched how the fish seemed to go move towards the flow of the water that came off the lands, especially off the lo'i, and the phytoplankton is in the water and the fish can smell it, so they're drawn to it. And so they looked at where the tides were flowing and ebbing and flowing, and they built their fish ponds so that the little fish could go in and out with the tides, and then they'd feed on the phytoplankton and they'd get fat and they couldn't get out, and that was domesticated fish. They're brilliant.
Yeah, the indigenous knowledge, what we're appreciating now. And to them, it was just, this is how we know there's balance.
Yeah.
Right?
And they understood that native systems have evolved over millions of years, and that even just the microorganisms and the plants and the bees and the pollinators and the mammals and all the plants and trees and stuff are all, they've evolved to work together really well. And the Native Hawaiians understand that, for example, an ohia tree on the Waianae Range won't do well on the Ko'olau Range and vice versa. So they, every single even valley has its own ecosystem. It's incredible, actually. And in fact, right now, Laukahi is working on a special book where they apply scientific names to Native Hawaiian trees. And it's a first. probably first in the whole world. So there's a lot of stuff happening out there in the Native Hawaiian community.
Well, you know, we just talked to someone who's a farmer who said that he's involved in a project to try and encourage more people to grow native flowers for lei, to help the lei industry, because so much is imported. And he's trying to emphasize just the pride in knowing that these are local plants, native plants, and it's an industry and part of the culture that we're supporting.
There may be an opportunity now with rebuilding Wailua that maybe we can look at the opportunity to grow native flowers when they rebuild the area. Maybe there's some grants that are available.
Yeah, just what we can do to propagate, right, those natives, whether they find them up on the mountaintop in remote areas, to bring them down, nurture them if they're endangered. Mm-hmm. You know, there may be plants that there were so few left out in the wild. It sounds like the Garden Club is trying to nurture that appreciation for what Hawaii has to offer.
Absolutely. But the other thing is, again, with the heat waves that are coming on and the change in climate that we're seeing, only the natives will really survive it. All of the other invasives won't survive it. They just aren't suited to this environment. So it's for the long run, best for the long run.
Yeah. So your theme, imagine that.
Yeah. Imagine a Native Hawaiian landscape garden throughout the whole island chain.
You know, I had the opportunity to go up to Mount Ka'ala, and it was just so eye-opening to see the native flora and fauna and the native snails that are thriving in plants that you don't see down in the lower, hotter areas. And so, yeah, it, when you see what could be,
yeah,
imagine that, the possibilities.
I'm going to have to look into that. That sounds, you're so lucky.
Yes, I am. Very fortunate that there are so many people that I've gotten to meet that care about the place that we live and we call home.
If you get to the flower show, I'd be happy to show you around. I'll show you the plants that we have. There are going to be native plants in a lot of the floral design exhibits as well, especially with the vegetative. There's this one class where you have to use the same flowers that have grown together in nature into your display. There is going to be botanical arts where they make jewelry and different objects out of plant material.
Oh, I love that.
Oh, good. Yeah. Good. Yeah. And photography. There's going to be a lot on the native scenes that we have around the islands. One of my favorites, though, is something called a par class. And in traditionally, it's been in that sort of opening entry courtyard. Mm-hmm. And these are plants that are like sometimes 30, 40 years old that are owned by members, and they bring it out once a year or once every 3 years, rather. And those are so much fun to see what your plants can be if you care for it right. I'm far away from that with my own plants, but something to aspire to.
Yeah, they're like legacy plants.
They
right?
are. Or, they're gorgeous, and they're huge. They're amazing.
Okay, well, I can't wait. But thank you so much for sharing more about what the Garden Club is all about.
It's my pleasure.
That was Sharon Williams, president of the Garden Club of Honolulu, who stopped by our studios recently. We'll have more on this tomorrow, but check out our website later today for links to find out about the upcoming flower and horticulture show at the Honolulu Museum of Art.
Support for HPR comes from KTA Superstores, committed to supporting Hawaii food producers and makers. Learn more about its locally sourced Mountain Apple brand products at ktasuperstores.com.
Balinese shadow puppets take the stage this week at the University of Hawaii's Kennedy Theater at the Manoa campus. A 52-person cast of shadow casters, dancers, and actors have been rehearsing for the last 6 months to put on the production of Panji and the Lost Princess. The conversation's Kevin Allen spoke with the two directors of the show, Kirsten Pauka and Imari Moja. Moja starts us off by explaining why they chose the Panji story.
So the story actually coming from Java, and then we bring it to Bali into very classical performance, the gamba. The story picked this one because we have a writer, so he's also a musician, dalang, and a puppeteer. So we asked him about to rewrite this story.
The name Panji is used in Java. In Bali, it's actually called Raden Ino Katapati. And the name also changes a lot when the character comes into story material on mainland Southeast Asia, where it's then called Prince Inao. So it's basically an adventure story, a romance that features loyalty and magic and travel adventures as the two fated lovers trying to get together and then cannot because of all these other mishaps and misfortunes and, you know, stuff that happens when you travel. And so it's a great platform to write episodes that are, depending on your audience, more focused on the romance or more focused on the adventure.
And also in terms of shadow puppet and shadow play, we use a very, very big screen. It's a totally different representation about Panji. So in this case, the Panji story we bring into the big shadow screen and then also dance as well. Yeah.
Right. And so in this production, you have a lot of moving parts.
No kidding.
Dancers, you have actors, you have puppeteers, you have shadow casters, you have musicians. Tell me what it's like to wrangle all of these threads together for this production you guys are putting on.
Well, this is really interesting and really challenging and in good way. The background about shadow puppet in Bali is only one person doing the puppet. In this case, we have nine people. So we try to figure out how, you know, almost like live movie. So everybody has a role. Sometimes just move the scenery and they're moving the puppet. And then we have a light source, different light source. I think 8 lights we have.
Because lights play such a big Vital. Role for shadows, yeah. Obviously.
Yeah, and so I always say that this kind of type of theater requires teamwork on a much higher level, on like a magnitude up from normal theater productions. I mean, all theater is teamwork and all theater is ensemble work, as we know. But this style of theater is literally like a clock, and every little part has to move just perfectly. And so we have a cast of 52. And just imagine, you know, the detail work that goes into every scene. So what the audience sees on the screen might look simple, but maybe it takes 12 people on the back end to make it work that way. So I always tell my students, you know, it's like shooting a movie, except for shooting a whole movie in one take. No breaks, no redos, you know.
Right. It's like those scenes you see in the movies, right, where it's like the one shot scene and then they do the behind the scenes and there's 500 people running and changing everything.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it feels like.
You guys are doing that at Kennedy Theater.
Life. There's nothing that's pre-recorded on the screen. It's not like, you know, we're recording what's on the screen and then just play that. You know, every moment on the screen that the audience sees is created in the moment by our puppeteer and shadow team that moment, you know. And so that's why we rehearsed for 6 months to make that actually, you know, go well.
And it must have been a lot of fun, though, with this shadow puppetry as a different method of storytelling that you're using live. I mean, you can really, I guess, get playful with it, right? Because now you're not bound by the laws of physical reality. You have a lot more visual reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of aesthetically involved with this light form because we use a different light source. We can move getting smaller, getting bigger, and then since we use multiple lights, kind of like the light we can see as a camera, you know, like when you turn one light, this camera on. When we turn it off and switch the other light, this a camera on. If you look in the screen, you know, because a lot of switching the light, and then if one scene people standing big, and then we can transfer to the small puppet, and then we can switch in certain way. I mean, we can switch the light, and they're kind of quite interesting, you know. Sometimes very hard to describe it if you didn't look at the process, especially in the backstage, you know.
Yeah, audiences always are curious about what the backstage is like. And sometimes we do like VIP tours to just show them, you know, the setup. But also Pamoja mentioned that certain characters appear like in three forms. So you have the downstage of the screen, 3D dancers in traditional Balinese costume, beautiful headpieces. The same character appears as a shadow character with a shadow mask behind the screen, and then also sometimes as various different size puppets. So the same character is voiced by the same actor, but it can be a small puppet, it can be a big puppet, it can be a shadow caster with a shadow mask, and it can be the 3D actor or actress themselves downstage. So there's a lot of transitions that need to be worked out because you have to switch from the outfit in front to the outfit that works in the screen, and that's not the same, especially for the head.
And in this situation, I tried to bring downstage and the backstage using shadow, how to make the character look almost like the same, kind of like the same profile. And then at the people dancing downstage, they use the makeup and use a headdress. But when they're going back, so you have to change the headdress to make it more like for the puppet purpose. And that is interesting to change from the front and the back. So I have to figure out how the profile's going to look like.
And we're really lucky that Pamoja is actually also a painter. And he can basically create the image, the profile of our actors as they look downstage, and then to reflect that in the shadow mask design. So it's recognizable who those characters are, you know, which takes a lot of work. You know, it's taken him several months to make that connection.
And it's the aesthetic, too, is such a wonderful, colorful Balinese aesthetic. I love from what I've seen of the costumes and the headpieces. And did you make all of those, or were they brought in? I'm just curious to hear how
it's
you guys...
It's a mixture. We brought in a lot of basic elements, costume elements from the previous show, so we have quite a good stock of, and they can be recombined and modified. And then Pamoja also built quite a bit of headpieces and other things.
Because I have a certain... the one headdress or two headdress, we don't have it. So instead, we bring it from Bali, so I had to make it here. So of course, the way we make it differently, and instead, for example, we use a rawhide or leather, we use a cardboard, but still look the same type of headdress. Yeah.
What were some of the major challenges?
Scheduling.
Yeah.
Trying to schedule like a cast of 52 people for 6 months, you know, is a major undertaking, and so it's the hardest thing to do, frankly, and probably every theater person would agree, you know, unless you have a professional company that does nothing but your show, you know, with students who have work and other classes and maybe even other productions, it's a big juggling act. But you know, we pulled it off, so we are in a good place right now. Since we're basically an educational institution, the whole main point is to really educate our students about this genre of music and this genre of dance and this genre of theater, and to basically give them amazing experience that they don't have anywhere else in the world, unless they maybe move to Bali. And so the unique training for this shadow acting is really that most Western actors are so much in their own body that it's a real new experience for them to basically become a shadow puppet themselves. And so they don't act in their body, but they have to look at their shadow and make their shadow work, and then have their shadow express their emotions and have their shadow do all the proper movement and collaboration with the other partners, other shadow characters. And so that's one of the hardest things, but it's also, I think, the most rewarding thing in the training process.
Yeah, and it's not challenge, just interesting to show the student how to make a shadow. Sometimes, or just making shadow, sometimes they don't think about so much what they have to learn, what have to be aware about the shadow. So, for example, you make shadow, and then you look the shadow, and then you look the partner, the interactive, how to interactive, you know. So you're not interactive with what is in front of your eyes, you're interactive in the shadow.
Yeah, I keep thinking of it. This is the closest we can ever get to like out-of-body experience, because we're really making the shadow be the character, right? So yeah, it's a really wonderful process.
And that was Kristen Pauka, director of the University of Hawaii's Asian Theater Program, and Imade Moja. Their show is called Panji and the Lost Princess. It debuts this Friday at the UH Kennedy Theater. Find a link to tickets on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And that does it for us for today's show. Thank you for spending time with us on The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Now back to Meredith and Savannah at the pitch table.